Hyperion to a Satyr.
Welcome to the 43rd episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid. And
oh, I know Siskoid, and what Shakespeare says with irony, I say with conviction. What a piece of work is Siskoid. How Arcadian in reason. How infinite in podcastery. In fire, in water, how express and networked. In action, how like an improviser. In games mastery, how like a Torg. The beauty of Hamlet. The spokesperson o' the folio. And yet to me, what is this quintessence of the Dane? The Dane delights not me. Brackets, though Macbeth he does. Though by your smiling, you seem to say no.
No, Macbeth sucks. Okay, so I'm still trying to get my goat up about that. Folks, I'll present a guest eventually, because I'll have to, I suppose. But as you know, I've just fairly recently finished my scene-by-scene deep dive look at Hamlet, the true masterpiece, through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations. So we're now looking at singular adaptations that weren't part of the original corpus used on the podcast. And today, we're discussing Hamlet Goes Business by the great Finnish director Aki Kaurismäki, a modern adaptation of Shakespeare's classic. And with me today is a returning guest. Gosh. But he suggested this film, indeed brought my attention to it. So all joking aside, Ryan Blake, very happy to have you on the show. How are you doing?
I'm good. After your scandalous comments about Macbeth there in the intro, I understood when he said, you know, time creeps in this petty pace day after day. But we're here to talk about Hamlet and Hamlet Goes Business, and I shall try to comport myself as befitting a Thane rather than a wayward student that's moping about because his dad's dead.
So this was a very fun version of Hamlet, but as we'll see, it's also a bit of a takedown, which kind of makes sense for your appearance on the show. I mean, Kaurismäki is a director that I already had on my radar. Very deadpan, dry humor, but often some quite heavy subjects. So I'm thinking of Le Havre or The Other Side of Hope, which are really about the refugee crisis in Europe. Bitter Leaves, which was a very recent one, 2023, I think, which is kind of an awkward rom-com, but it's also talking about the war in Ukraine. So I've seen a half a dozen of his films, I think, and I want to obviously see more, but I hadn't seen this one. Had you seen more than just this particular film?
I had seen Le Havre, as you said.
Yes.
And Leningrad Rats Go America was my favorite of his. And I've seen some of the others, but the thing is, a lot of the time, the versions I get only have the Finnish title and English subtitles. So I don't actually know the names of some of the ones that I've seen. Now, I've almost certainly seen two or three of the ones you've listed, but I would break my tongue trying to pronounce them because Finnish is not my wheelhouse.
Yeah, Leningrad Cowboys Go to America, very fun, kind of early picture. And there's a sequel to that, I think, or a couple of sequels, really.
Yes. Yes, yeah. And I've seen those as well, but I cannot remember for the life of me. I just know it's Leningrad Rat something something.
Leningrad Cowboy. I think in English it's called Leningrad Cowboys Meet Moses.
That's it.
Yeah,
that's it.
That's it.
Yes.
So anyways, we rate this director. I imagine.
Yeah, definitely.
I definitely rate this director. And his version of Hamlet was a hoot, I got to say. And I mean, reputedly, Kaurismäki read the play for the first time and then wrote the loose script 2 weeks before filming. It's really just like a reaction to a first read. He just produced another director's Macbeth. And the idea was that someone would make also a King Lear to close the trilogy, and it never happened. So it was like a project really early in his career. He's maybe 30 years old when he made this in 1987. And I mean, he's still working today. You know, he's still producing films today. So it's fairly early. And some say that it's the first film, Hamlet Goes Business, where all of the trademarks of his style are all in there together. So this is like his first polished film, but it obviously was made very quickly, written very quickly. And I see it as a non-serious reaction to a first read of the play. In that sense, it delighted me.
I don't know if you would have seen this, but when this came out, I mean, I was too young to sort of watch it, but I watched an interview. There's a person in England called Jonathan Ross who is more or less I suppose, for a shortcut for anyone listening on that side of the Atlantic, he's the English version of David Letterman.
Right. I think we know who Jonathan Ross is, not to be confused with the assert murderer.
But he interviewed Aki, and they got into an argument, like live on the interview thing, because Jonathan Ross was saying, this is not really a version of Hamlet. Like, it's not a literal version of Hamlet. And he argued and said, no, yes, it is. And he said, well, you can't translate the rubber duck into Hamlet and, you know, you've changed various parts. And he goes, no, this is a version of Hamlet. And I remember the argument got really, like, vitriolic. And he didn't exactly storm off, but the interview broke down. And I do remember thinking, I need to see this. And I did, not that much later. It was hilarious. Once we've gone through the analysis of this quote-unquote version of Hamlet, I would like to get what your theories on how much can you, you know, the ship of Theseus argument, how much can you change before it's no longer Hamlet?
I think you can change quite a lot, actually, because it depends. Well, we'll talk about it, but when you have several accesses to Hamlet, and one of them is simply the plot. So if you do the plot, it's still Hamlet, but is it still the core of the play, which is not the plot? The themes and then you could do the themes, you could change the plot, in other words, and then you would come up with different notions or it would say different things. And I think all of these versions are legit in a sense that even if it's not Hamlet per se and it's not Shakespeare's vision, it is a comment on the play. And so it is useful to people who do stage or act the play. We were talking just before, and I've seen like three different versions of Hamlet this week. One of which is at the National Theatre Live presentation of the 2026 version, which is Hamlet as a tragicomedy. It's more of a, you know, they're pushing the comedy elements, and I think the play is flawed as a result. There are a lot of interesting things in it.
No, I remember reading your blog entry on it. It was fascinating because I was planning to see that myself. So,
and the other one is we finally got Hamnet. People have been bugging me about it for weeks.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
But it wasn't coming to our theatres. They often do that. They're sort of Oscar waiting, I would call it. Once the Oscar nominations come out, then they'll take those films because they know they'll have more people going. Finally saw Hamlet, and of course there's a version of Hamlet in there. And that was extremely touching. You know, if I'd seen it last year, I would have called it the best film of last year, which...
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, because I've got a very strong opinion on Hamlet.
It is a film about catharsis, and that's something that theater has been providing since the ancient Greeks. Yeah, no, I was extremely touched by it. Nevertheless, these are all cockeyed Hamlets. And then, actually, there's another one because I read a graphic novel this week called Hamlet, where Hamlet is a pig, and, and it's like funny animals and sort of a remix, a happy-go-lucky kind of remix of not just Hamlet, but Shakespeare's plays. So, a lot of cockeyed Hamlets for me this week. And that sort of ties into this one, because just to give you a sense early on of the kind of dry humor that is in this, Hamlet is introduced in the kitchen where he sees a piece of ham and cuts himself a piece and he says, "Ham, let me." So Hamlet, me, in Finnish, but you know, that's what the subtitles say. So it's absolutely ridiculous in a sense. The question I want to ask is, well, what about this setting, right? Hamlet goes business. We're in a business world, but it's also, I think the genre is more important here. It's built like a film noir. So it's in black and white, where we live in a corrupt world. We have a cynical anti-hero in Hamlet. Ophelia's a femme fatale, you know? So,
well, yeah.
In a way. So what did you think of just this idea for a setting, and does it fit the play? Would it, If they'd followed the plot more closely, would it still work for you?
I think it does fit. I think, like you said, there's different ways into Hamlet. And I think setting it like this, I'm going to make a really obvious two really obvious comparisons here. One of which is the version from the year 2000 that you've already reviewed with Ethan Hawke, which...
This predates.
This predates by quite a bit, but it's comparable.
Yep.
And also, I wanted to ask, when did the film Wall Street come out? Because I feel like there's a Finnish Wall Street in here.
It's around this time, isn't it?
It must be around this time. Yeah, yeah. And I have no idea if one influenced the other.
Year, 87.
Same year, okay. The court becomes the boardroom. You know, kingship becomes ownership. Political legitimacy becomes corporate control.
Yep.
And weirdly, revenge, if there is revenge in this, in the straight out sense of the word, becomes like strategic restructuring of the company. So it's like you said, you know, it's a corrupt world. In a more straight blowing version of Hamlet, Hamlet is paralyzed by morality. And in this, he's surrounded by a world where morality is completely irrelevant. I mean, you talked about catharsis earlier on. Catharsis might as well be a swear word in this play. Don't go looking for it in this version, because there ain't none, mister.
No, it's not that kind of thing, right? So, like, restaging it as film noir and then respecting the tropes of that genre means that Hamlet can't be the same kind of character. He has to be much darker for the thing to work. I mean, you could have done it where he's sort of the wronged man type character. That's also part of the genre. But that's not what they're going with here. And so we'll be talking about the various differences that this creates, not just in the characters, but in the plot itself, because the director was not beholden to the strict facts of the play.
No, definitely not.
Any more than the language, right? Because this is maybe the least verbose adaptation possible outside of silent cinema.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was looking at this through, because I teach Hamlet in college in England. Hamlet is one of the Shakespearean texts.
Of course.
That and Othello are the two main ones. They want everyone to learn Macbeth because it's more important. So that's GCSE level, high school level. I was looking at it through that lens and I was thinking, in a weird backhanded way, this would be really good to show students, because like you said, the flowery text is removed and people are outright saying, it's almost like there's a series of books you've probably heard of called No Fear Shakespeare, where they have the Shakespearean text next to plain English, modern English.
Yep.
This is almost that in some parts of it, where people are saying, I don't trust you because you did this. I don't like this because of this. And they're kind of spelling out what maybe a beautiful soliloquy might be saying in the original sort of Hamlet. So on one level, it's a really good introduction to Hamlet if you can stomach it. And it's a really terrible intro if you want to get all of the essence of Shakespeare's linguistic sort of motifs and beauty.
Because it is a takedown, is what I'm calling a takedown.
Yes.
I don't think that the director really enjoyed the experience of reading it.
I was going to say, Do you think he liked the play? Because,
Theater is meant to be seen. And so reading the text, and I, of course, you've got some critics who say you can only read the text. Like, every staging will be disappointing to a literary critic. Harold Bloom famously said this about Shakespeare's plays, and it's like, it's meant to be read, and you only can only get every little ounce out of it if you read it rather than see it, because then there are choices made on stage. So I get it from a critic's perspective. But at the same time, here, for example, the movie starts with a dog whining. And we'll see the dog again at the end. Like, to me, this is like the ultimate insult, right? It's Hamlet is a dog whining. That's what I got from the play, and that's how it starts. I felt like that.
I think it was a female dog. So it was a whiny little bitch, much like Hamlet is a whiny little bitch.
Right.
Regardless of whether the version of Hamlet is great or not, he's a whiny little bitch. Apologize for my language. That's not even a criticism of the play. I think that's part of his idiom, that he does whine.
That's one take, and it's a frequent take. It doesn't need to be like that. I mean, the actor can do other things.
At all.
But yes. So every kind of film noir choice is sort of informing the, well, I'm reading this and I don't think it's very realistic, or it's not relevant to today. So I'll make changes, and these changes are really comments on his appreciation of the play. Ophelia and Polonius as gold diggers. One of the funniest thing is how Horatio, the chauffeur, couldn't give a rat's ass what Hamlet has to say.
Simo in this, that was just outright, well, I don't know if it's outright comedy, but I took that as outright comedy.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when we get to talking about the end of the play. I mean, that was, it was genius, but it was genius in the most cynical way possible. Like, when he's just there and he goes, I don't care what you're saying. I don't care what you're thinking. And he literally tells him that.
Yeah.
I mean, he literally says that to him. It was brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. I laughed like a drain.
Hamlet is sort of talking, even when he's speaking to Horatio, and this is something that, you know, that people have brought up in the past in other stagings, etc. It's like Horatio is just a sounding board. Some people like to think that he's not even there, and that, you know, he's like a figment of his imagination.
Hmm.
And it's sort of a reaction to soliloquies in general, which have largely been cut here. Why are people talking to no one? Of course, in film, it's a little ridiculous, whereas on stage, you're having a conversation with the audience. But nevertheless, it's like, are you still talking? It's like, why are you saying these thoughts out loud? I'm not listening. I don't care about this. So that, to me, was extremely funny. You also have, of course, we'll talk about that portrayal of Hamlet, but he's a ruthless, aloof Hamlet, who is himself a callous murderer. So that's kind of in, I mean, that's kind of in the play in the sense that, you know, by the time he has Rosencrantz and Guildenstern killed, which here is much more immediate, like he does it himself.
Yeah, he really does.
You have to question, like, okay, this guy like spends, I don't know how long the play might last on stage, but let's say he spends 2.5 hours, 3 hours refusing to kill someone who he has some justification for killing. And then at the end, he's killing everybody, you know, like he doesn't care anymore. I think Korosmaki is always either making fun of or criticizing or rewriting the Danish play. And I'm there for it, honestly.
Yeah, no, I mean, me too. It's because the thing is, it's like any adaptation, you know, the original text is still there. There's nothing to sort of get upset about or anything like that. Or like, you know, Hamlet fanboy saying, no, this is wrong, which is kind of what Jonathan Ross did really in the interview.
Yeah. But
the one thing that really I had to sort of reconcile is kind of what you've just touched on, is that, and I sort of mentioned earlier, Hamlet is this guy who thinks too much, you know, oh, what a rogue and peasant knave am I, and all that jazz. In this, there is no hesitation. He's a Wall Street shark. Or whatever the Finnish version of Wall Street is. He is a total shark in this. He just, right, plan, execute. There's no hesitation. There's very little sentiment. I mean, even the ghost of his dad tells him, you're useless, but you probably love me enough to know what happened, kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And then that gets inverted later on. That was the biggest sort of hurdle for me to really get to grips with this version of Hamlet, because, you know, Hamlet thinks a lot, he pauses a lot, he asks questions, he tries to figure things out, he tries to confirm stuff. And in this, you could practically hear the Jaws theme when he comes into the room, you know, so which I found incredibly interesting. The way his world is, Hamlet is holding up this idea of, you know, we shall not look upon his like again. You know, there is a greater good. There is a spiritual good, however you want to put it. And in this, pardon my French, but everything's a big old pile of crap. You know, there's nothing aspirational in this at all, you know, which made it really kind of like not a tough watch, but tough in the sense of, like, for example, in American Psycho, we get shown capitalism as a form of psychosis. In like Succession, we get capitalism as like family trauma. But in Hamlet Goes Business, capitalism is fate. It's a machine that makes everyone irrelevant and replaceable. It's a bit like 1984 or Brazil in that regard.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when the end credits roll and we're just looking at the machines, right, of this factory, I guess it's a, what is the business? I mean, at some point they want to they want to corner the rubber duck market from Norway. Yeah. That's sort of the Fortinbras.
Yeah, that's the Fortinbras' rubber ducks.
but it's actually a wood processing plant. Okay, that we're seeing. So it's kind of the wood chipper, right? The grind of whatever's happening in the play and this world, it's just the wood chipper. We're just, you can say it's kind of akin to the dialogue around the gravesite in the actual play. Alexander and the wood chipper is kind of the idea behind it. So that's interesting. Let's talk about some of the changes that they made. One of the things I think it has in common with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, which is also intersecting with the play, but also being comedic, that same kind of dry humor. But otherwise, it's how it shows the scenes the play doesn't show, right? Like the play itself starts at minute 12. Everything before that is prologue.
Yeah, a prequel.
Yeah, we see the murder. We see an ongoing relationship between Hamlet and Ophelia. We see how Claudius, who's called Klaus here, came to power, and why Hamlet is loved by the people, and yet is still disruptive at court. Or board meetings. You know, Gertrude informs her son about the second marriage. We see a lot of these scenes that are sometimes even not spoken of in the actual play.
It's important to remember, like you said, we're dealing with like the sort of satire of Hamlet. And as you said, you know, the center of this in your more straightforward Hamlet is his mind is the center, or his heart, his spirit, whatever. And in this, it's the company, it's capitalism. So everything is in that light. I mean, this film, I genuinely think, could not work if it was in colour. It would not work. It would be too much of a contrast, because we've already got, because you talked about the end with the paper machine, you know, the grind of that, and the music that completely contrasts with it, that talks about friendship and having a happy life, you know, and sort of seizing the day. And throughout all of this, the music was an interesting one for me, because it's film noir. So some of the music in this is very diegetic, and some of it is very film noir. How heavy-handed was the film noir bits of the music that weren't diegetic for you?
That weren't diegetic?
Yeah.
I think it lent, even the diegetic music, right? There's a sort of rockabilly aesthetic to the music that makes you think of his Leningrad Cowboys stuff.
Oh, I would have paid real money for it to have been the Leningrad Cowboys be the band in that bar they're in. I was praying it was them.
I want to talk about that particular bit later when we talk about like specific characters. But yes, at first I thought, is it? And it was like, no, the haircuts aren't extreme enough. nevertheless, that whole music where, and sometimes it's like in the play, which is very talky, there would be a speech here. There would be dialogue here. Mm. And instead, Hamlet will just like slap a jukebox and it'll start playing. Or
yes. Yeah. And the music subverts the mood of the scene.
And I think that's the whole point. The subversion of the tragedy by the music, whether diegetic or not, it's part of that fun. I think it's part of that takedown or that satire or that spoofing that is going on. Sort of kind of to make it, yes, we're kind of in the 50s or early 60s or something. You know, we're in another time where it's black and white, etc., rather than in strictly in 87. That may be part of the aesthetic, but I think it's just part of the rejection of the tragedy as a tragedy. So to me, it was part of that landscape and it part of the fun of it. Whereas if it were more dour or dirge-like, or then maybe the movie is too dark. And I do believe it's a comedy. So I think the music makes it more of a comedy.
It's an incredibly black comedy, but it is definitely a comedy. We also get told in passing by, I think, Polonius, that it's a police state as well, which adds another layer to it.
One of the things that I liked about what they did here, and that is left rather unexplained in the play, we hear from various parts that, first of all, thank you everyone for going along with this affair, blah, blah, blah. Claudius has taken over, but it's not really his. Like, that's one of the problems of the play. Why isn't Hamlet the king? The succession would be that he would be king. Why is Claudius interfering with that? And how did it happen? How can it happen? In the play, it's left to, well, thank you, court, for doing this, for going along with it, even though it's not strictly legal. And maybe Hamlet's a bit mopey, so whatever. And there is, I was listening to Ian McKellen talking about Hamlet and the couple times he's done it, etc. He's talking with other Hamlets. He was asked, what do you think it would be like the Hamlet you would like to see, that he'd never seen, but you'd love to see? And he said, I'd love to see it played by like a 14-year-old.
Oh.
Because then the doubt and the you know, all the reasoning behind him not being king yet, the relationship with Ophelia and the sort of grandstanding and how much of a pressure that would be on a teenager. Your father's dead and your mother's remarried. And all of those emotions might work much better or more interestingly with a kid Hamlet.
Yeah, I can see the logic of that, yeah.
I think that's an interesting take. And as far as we know, it hasn't really been done or not in the mainstream. I mean, maybe in schools or, you know. I don't know. It's a bit...
Well, yeah, literally, yeah.
Yeah, it's a big bite for a, you know, for a high school or something. But nevertheless, what they do here, and so we know this happens, but we don't know how it happens. We later learn that Hamlet is very popular with the population. And we're like, really? They're not part of this play. In this, they actually address it. First of all, we see how it's like, well, Hamlet's gonna, you know, he'll sit on the board, but he doesn't really want to do this. His dad's dead. He's not interested in the leadership of the company. What they don't know is that he is very extremely interested in the...
Yeah.
But regardless, so they make this move and they will run the board as much more of a regency than what we see in the play. The other thing is the whole thing with the merger or the takeover of the Norwegian company, and they were part of these machinations. They're going to close down plants and they're going to close down
the shipyard.
The shipyard. Yeah, exactly. And so people are going to lose their jobs there. Hamlet is against this. Hamlet, the final vote that, you know, prevents this from happening.
Yeah.
So in other words, he just has enough agency in the company to prevent things. And as we'll find out, Horatio is really a spy for the unions. It gets back to, probably it gets back to them. So if Hamlet is popular with the population, it's because he's the good boss, or so we think. He's the good boss versus Klaus, who is the bad boss, who for money will do anything, including cut jobs, etc. It's a story we know well from our own time, as true now as it was in the 80s. So I think that's like, okay, now we're getting these pieces that I wish were in the play. So see, even when we're completely subverting how the play goes, we're inserting scenes, it's still going to inform my understanding of the actual play. Because in the actual play, you know, there may be a something that we can imagine similar in between the lines.
Yeah, it's kind of filling in certain gaps that you know must have happened, but now we're actually seeing them. And we're seeing them in a very blunt way. Now, here's a question for you, because the part where Claudius is saying, oh yeah, as you know, he'll sit at his kiddie's table, he just likes drawing with his crayons. I assume that was a metaphorical, you know, that he was saying, oh, he's just a kid, he doesn't really know anything, he just sits on the board to look important, he doesn't really care about the business.
Yeah, like he doodles and
He doodles, yeah, which, fine, okay. But then when we actually get there, he's literally sitting at a kiddie table that is markedly lower than everyone else's, a full-grown man. And he's literally drawing with crayon. And he's drawing a picture of like a happy family by a house as well.
That's the madness, right? The way he feigns madness. I think that this is part of the satire of it. It's like, yes, he's a grown man. He doesn't look slight in any way. And it's like, he's even a big man.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, we see him reading comics, which surely...
Yes.
No adult would do.
That was a bit of a bite, that one, because when Palomni says, oh, he just reads and reads and reads, obviously in the original play, it's not going to be comics. And I just, yeah, when they said, oh no, that's childish.
But I think he's feigning madness. I mean, that's not pushed very far, the whole madness thing. Just enough.
No. Do you think he was playing the long game then? Like Hamlet had been drawing with crayons at executive board meetings for quite a while to build up to this.
Yes, because as we find out, he's much more of a mastermind than in the play.
Yes.
So we also see him spy on the meetings that he's not in.
Yes.
So he knows what's happening and he's disarming his enemies by making it seem not so much that he's mad, but that he's a child and not a threat, unprepared for any of this, uninterested in any of it, so that he can better blindside them later. What do we think of the Hamlet-Ophelia relationship in this? Because normally she is forced by Polonius to deny him access to her. In this, the access is not to Ophelia so much as to sex. So we see her refuse to have sex with him until he marries her, I imagine.
Yep, that's it. That's what she says. I think she actually outright says that. There's not a lot of subtext in this. It's pretty much all text in most ways.
Yeah, they spell it out. And he keeps pushing for sex, and she refuses sex. And he's not like pushing himself on her. There's always going to be consent, it seems. But she refuses that consent. In the play, she's told that she can't be with Hamlet and blah, blah, blah. In this, Polonius, yes, Laertes doesn't want them to be together because he's sort of a jealous sort who works at that company and, you know, he's not having a lot of luck. Very pathetic character. So he doesn't want her to be with Hamlet, but Polonius does. So that's like one of the first big changes that we notice, not just in the structure, but in like the plot. They're gold diggers. It's like, if you marry Hamlet, then we have a claim on the company, essentially. You know, Polonius is also working his angles.
They're Catholic, so they'll be too expensive to divorce.
That's a big change. And essentially, they're also the notion that Laertes and Ophelia are twins, which is not in the play.
No.
But makes sense given the absence of the mother. If she died in childbirth, neither of them had their mother ever. I mean, it's a small detail, but it's not addressed in the play, right?
Yeah, and Polonius says, your mother was weak. You've got too much of your mother's weak blood in you. Laertes has got too much her mother's weak blood in you, which is why he's a good person. Which, again, good is very much in air quotes in this
relative
version.
Yeah, so what did you think of this whole relationship and how it changes our view of the play?
We get hit over the head very early on that Hamlet is... pardon my French, he's horny. He wants to sleep with Ophelia. That's the one thing he keeps going on about. And this version of Ophelia, basically, they strip the poetry from her. And the romance is this transactional, disposable thing. She will sleep with him if he marries her, because then they have a connection to the company, you know, and the 51% shareholder. And in this, I think Ophelia basically ends up representing a sort of index of what capitalism destroys. Her softness is kind of gone. Her vulnerability is sort of there, but it's a commodity to be traded. This idea of love must be for profit. You know, she's not a feminist prism here. She's a casualty of sort of dehumanizing sort of rationality.
Right.
You know, it's not just the patriarchy that destroys her, it's bureaucracy. It's the corporate culture. So Ophelia's sensitivity is not tragic beauty in this play or this film. It's a liability. It's really fascinating. And I kept count. There are only three instances where anyone smiles in this play. One of them is when Macbeth is... Hamlet.
Yeah.
He's sort of like sort of creeping up to her when they're outside shopping, and he gives her a smile that is so creepy. Like, tonight's the night. We can have sex tonight. There's another time, I think, when they're watching The Mousetrap. The only other smile in this play is when Ophelia, spoiler alert, kills herself because she's just, I think she's just happy to be out of this world. That smile is like the only time when Ophelia displays any emotion truly on her face, because I think she's such a, I don't know if it's fair to say, she's a pawn in this play. Maybe not a pawn. I don't know what the next level up would be in terms of chess piece, because she knows what she's doing. But I never get the impression that she's really choosing what she's doing, because she's still going along with Polonius's plan.
Yes, and later it does seem revealed, like once Polonius is dead, why does she commit suicide? It seems like she really is in love with Hamlet, even though at the beginning of the film, it's clear that this is transactional. So, I mean, maybe she grew to love him, although, is he lovable?
Well, there is that. Because the cynical view would be, well, her meal ticket has now rejected her. But on top of that, I thought... And this was how much the film affected me. I thought, she looks at the photo of him, hugs it to her face, then throws it away. And I just remember thinking, right, what happened immediately before this? Hamlet said, no, we're done. I was making it up. I don't really love you. I'm not interested.
Yep.
And I was thinking, in this world, is it so cynical that Ophelia suddenly wants Hamlet because he doesn't want her?
Sure.
And it's as simple as that. You know, it's just this, it's a really, the most cynical way.
Well, it's not so cynical. I think it's very human. And I think I had the same reaction, actually, that the realization that, oh, I actually did have feelings for this person. That would be the non-cynical, not just I want to acquire the things that I can't acquire. Although the themes of the film may point to this more cynical interpretation.
Yeah.
And, you know, like...
Because it's flattened everyone's emotions, hasn't it?
Yeah, and Kiri Utinen, who plays Ophelia, she's a grown woman. She's a very haggard look in this film. She's, I wouldn't call her necessarily Kaurismäki's muse, but she's in a ton of his films. So he kept working with her beyond this point. And she works with this sort of deadpan kind of, you know, sad comedy that he's always doing. Like, she seems too old to be this naive pawn that we often see in, you know, different Ophelias. She seems already, like, pre-broken.
Yeah.
Like, she doesn't have, like, this madness scene that we have in the play. We go from the breakup to the suicide and in a bathtub and, you know, like they're doing the
brook. Oh, and the rubber duck, don't forget.
The rubber duck imagery, we'll have to talk about that if it means anything. But yeah, so her Ophelia is, I think, already broken by this whole situation, by the father who forces her into a relationship, by this relationship that is very cold by all accounts. I mean, he has moments of kindness, you know, like when he gets her the ice cream, which I think is a very funny moment because the ice cream comes out of nowhere.
Watching that scene, because I remember thinking, right, she wanted ice cream. Okay, so that's a symbol of innocence and all that jazz and makes sense. But the moment he walks off, I remember thinking, he's going to come back with the most unappetizing vanilla ice cream cone that does not look enticing at all. And from my view, he absolutely did. I remember seeing it thinking, I would not want to eat that. That just looks so bland. Even in this world, there's not even ice cream to look forward to.
It's a very tiny cone, isn't it? It's like a Cornetto.
That's also true, yeah.
But it comes out of nowhere. There's no vendor there. They're just like, it's night. They're looking at, through a window, like a shop window at night. You can't even go into the shop because it's closed. Yeah. Where is this ice cream coming from? I thought it was like one of those funny, ridiculous moments that he inserts into the narrative. But it is a moment of some kindness.
Do you think? Oh, that's interesting. Humor, yes. Kindness, I would question, maybe.
Well, whatever. I mean, this is still a man who is pressing her for sex. She keeps rejecting him, but he stays with her until eventually. But to me, all very funny till someone dies.
Because he never actually proposes, does he?
It's like they're both pressing each other. He wants sex, she wants marriage. And neither will give the other what they want.
Because she even says, you should speak to me in a more tender way if you were genuine.
The another change in here, more functional than anything, but Claudius is not the uncle, is merely the second in command of the company. So that's fine. They've removed the incestuous element, if you like. Well, we're talking about characters here, Ophelia, Claudius. So let's talk about the characters. And through that and the scenes that we want to explore, we'll talk about further changes to the play as they come up. But Hamlet, talked a lot about him. Performance by Pirkka-Pekka Petelius, who in the last decade has been a politician. Was an actor, of course, at this point. What do you think of his casting and his performance generally? And do you recognize some kind of Hamlet in him?
I mean, that's a very good question. I mean, there's obviously debate about how old should Hamlet be before it becomes sort of impractical. But the thing is, this is a Hamlet that needs to be a bit older because he needs to be part of the corporate world. He needs to be familiar with it because of the way they portray him in this is, he's another cog in the machine. Now, he's a cog that's maybe slightly more important, you know, to that machine. I mean, he looks like a Finnish Gordon Gekko, Michael Douglas' character in Wall Street, for people who don't know who that is. You know, he's got the same haircut. He wears the same suit throughout the whole play. And critically, well, I think critically, even when he's working out, he's got his suit on. He never actually shifts from that mode. Again, like I said before, like he's like a shark. I really like the performance. He is a thinker, but his thoughts are all corporate strategy. There's no sort of poetic element to him in this, again, which is why I suppose in some ways he's perfect for this version of Ophelia. I did like him. The thing is, this is not a Hamlet that holds to any particular virtue, at least not deliberately. And this is not a Hamlet that, as we find out, overly loves anybody particularly. I mean, he never protests his love for Ophelia in a very convincing way. You know, when he verbalizes anything, it's just about sex. We find out about his dad later on when we'll talk about that. You know, even his mum, I didn't really find there was a lot of warmth there.
So maybe the most
perfect
warmth
for this version. The most warmth, yeah. But whether that's like the difference between like lighting a matchstick and, you know, a blazing inferno, you know?
Well, I'll go to bat for that in the sense that usually in the play, because of the uncle element, probably, Hamlet is very angry at his mother, blames her for the tragedy, basically. But in this, he's against the marriage, notably.
Yeah.
But later, you know, when he comes back from his exile, if we can call it that here, he meets up with his mom and they're having a very warm moment. When she dies, he takes a lock of her hair. When we'll talk about all the deaths in the film versus the play,
yeah,
she dies way before the fight. So there's a moment there where he can reflect on her death. So there's a warmth, but there's also like the play is not a play, but the film is very cold. So every emotion is restrained, including any that we would call warm.
Yes.
And he has to play that.
Absolutely.
I think maybe this is a very ambitious Hamlet who has been planning a takeover of the company for a while. And let's say it, and this is the biggest change probably. And I wonder, is it a step too far? He turns out to be the killer of the father. You know?
Yes.
Claudius, and to a point, I guess it's not really Gertrude's fault. She has an affair with Klaus. That's clear.
Yeah.
And from that affair, he has been slowly poisoning.
It's weakening his heart.
Hamlet,
yeah.
Senior. And Hamlet knows all about this, probably been spying, etc. Knows all about this. It's not going quickly enough. So that night, he changes the poisons around so that Hamlet Senior will die more immediately. He's been planning this for a while, and you would think that also, why doesn't he just take over the company right then and there? He's got 51% of the shares, etc. Is probably because, well, then I'm stuck with the old guard who are all scheming and will come after me. So I got to get rid of the old guard as well before I take my place. All very interesting and cool, but is it a step too far to make Hamlet Senior's killer?
Here's the thing. One, yes, I think it is, in terms of Hamlet is driven by revenge and figuring out what form that revenge should take, whether he should take revenge. But the revenge is always there. In this, someone has stolen his thunder by trying to do it first. I mean, it's an odd thing because it questions all of his motivation. But here's the thing. I think the motivation for Macbeth, I keep referring to the superior play. So Hamlet, Hamlet's motivation... I know so much of this is going to get cut out now. Every Macbeth reference is going to get removed.
Every time Ryan speaks is going to get removed.
If this had been Macbeth, he would have just stabbed Klaus and his dad, and this play would have been so much shorter. Anyway.
I mean, that's true of the play, right? It's true of the play. It's about delay.
Yeah. But in this, I think The whole point of this is, and this almost speaks to a virtue in Hamlet, maybe in this version, I'm not sure. He wants escape. I don't think he wants, well, he obviously doesn't need revenge, but I think he saw the grind of this world that he's in. And as you said, he wants to get rid of the old guard, which is why he doesn't step in. And he's got this long-term plan. And he declares at the end, I'm going to sell everything and just go. So this Hamlet does not want revenge. Well, maybe he wants revenge in the sense of, you know, his dad represents the jailer of this world and he wants to break out in that sense, maybe. But this is a Hamlet that just wants escape. He just wants out of this life. We don't know where he's going to go or anything like that, but just he's going to go on a long journey. And he just makes one mistake in whom he reveals this plan to. And so if you think that revenge is so intrinsic to Hamlet that it's not Hamlet without that plot, then yeah, this is no longer a version of Hamlet. It's a sort of parallel play that's got lots of similarities, you know, because if you change the main character's fundamental motivation, is it then the same story? Because we have to question motivations.
Yes, but you could also say that it's a legitimate take to make escape, like the play's Hamlet's motivation.
But then we come on to be or not to be.
Because
don't
he doesn't want to take revenge. In the play, there is something moral about Hamlet, which is absent here. There's something moral about Hamlet that is part of that delay. He can't kill Claudius because murder is wrong. And it's only by the end that he's pushed to it or reconciles it. And, you know, it's like, well, I guess we're all going to hell. And so I've accepted it. But there's something stopping him, which may come from a place of morality or religiousness, which is definitely part of the play. But in this, like, he can't. Like, you know, that moment that maybe informs this is when in the confessional scene in the play, Hamlet stops himself because he doesn't want Claudius to go to heaven because he's praying. In this case, he's just interrupted.
It's just, yeah, I remember watching this thinking, how are they going to do this? Because there's no way this version of Klaus is praying to any god, unless he's praying to Satan, which would have been hilarious. But, you know, yeah. So what's going to stop him?
Yes, but he's in the room and there's a funny reveal where Claudius or Klaus doesn't realize he was in the room, but he was. It's like, well, Hamlet's somewhere. He's right there, you know. But they're interrupted in this moment. So, Klaus survives. But you could say that in the play, escape is a theme. It's like Hamlet wants to escape this situation. He doesn't want his parents to be married. He obviously doesn't want to be king, or else it would be much more of a thing, at least in the earlier parts of the play, the first three acts. He's not interested in this, and now he has a mission in which he's also not interested, feels he has to do it, but can't. So he's delaying the action consistently, because also doing it means his own damnation. I think escape is, you could say it's part of it.
You could, absolutely, yeah. But then, I mean, in this version...
Yeah, in this version, of course, that's kind of the whole thing. But at the same time, it's like, when does this become the plan? Because why not just run away, right? Why do you have to destroy the company?
Yeah, because he's got 51% of the shares. He's still going to get... I mean, even Klaus says he's still going to get, you know, I don't know the exact phrasing, but he's still going to get his stipend. He's still going to get money and he'll leave us alone.
So I think there may be a shift at some point. Well, I think the combo, death of Ophelia, death of Gertrude, by placing that earlier, maybe the shift. I'm going to get rid of all my enemies as I wanted to, but instead of now controlling the company, I'm done. I'm done. The two people that I may have loved are dead. So I want out. I don't want to be here in whatever version of Denmark this is. By making that decision, he ends up, like you said, selling out the workers, doing the very same thing that Claudius Klaus was going to do, closing down the shipyard, etc. Now this is going to be some sort of upheaval. He's going to just like destroy the company and the union can't have that. And as we'll find out, well, Horatio will have the last laugh as the union man.
Yeah, but there's a basic irony at work here, I think, because in this version of Hamlet, we don't get what I call the suicide bomber soliloquy, where he says to be or not to be, you know, where he's basically gearing up. You know, he's talking about, oh, do we come back from, is there anything, an afterlife? But also he talks about the law and status and society. He's preparing to die in this action. You know, maybe not, it's not his goal to die necessarily, but he's absolutely at peace with it. He's going to make this run at Claudius, etc. And in this version, it turns out he's kind of going to do the same, except we don't get the soliloquy. So we don't get anything about his mindset at all. We see it through physical actions, maybe, but we don't get this exploration of him. And like you said, maybe these two people who, one of whom his mum he definitely loves. I'm still on the fence about whether he loved Ophelia or not. But this idea of, you know, I'm done with this world completely is almost a sort of like, instead of leaving this life physically, he's leaving the corporate life. But I wanted to say, just really quickly, I want to say this. Because of the lady who plays Ophelia, the way her eyes are made up in this, I honestly really thought, and I'm so glad they didn't, because this may have been too far, I really thought they were going to reveal that on some level, Hamlet is her dealer and he's giving her drugs. And that's why her eyes look like that. And yeah. So she kills herself when Hamlet basically cuts her off. So it's not just he's going, but her drug supply is going as well. Because I really thought they were going to reveal she was a junkie. You know, the way they had her dress, the way her eyes went, her flatness. I really did feel that. And I'm glad they didn't. But I just wanted to put that in because that was my theory that they're going to put extra kick into it where it's even more cynical than we thought.
They did do that in the Fodor version, which I used in the body of the podcast. It works within the idea of a drowning, of a madness, etc. But yes, like she has like dark rings around her eyes. And like I said, she looks very haggard in this. You're right. It could have gone that way. Do we have notes on, let's go through some of the characters, on Klaus?
Well, what's your...
I just have a small note. I mean, he's a Claudius. I think it was an interesting change to make him during the mousetrap scene. He's the one who was an actor who played Julius Caesar rather than Polonius.
Yes.
And I thought, you know what? Maybe that works even better. I know Polonius is going to get stabbed soon after this, but the leader who is betrayed, I think, works just as well for Claudius. And making him an actor... you know, it's like, well, he's playing a part, isn't he? In the play, at least, he's playing a part. He's a false king, just like that player king. Or I think there are some interesting ideas around that little change.
He's part of the corporate power network. He's a corporate world invention. What I thought maybe I was reading too much in this. I don't know. But what I thought hilarious was, so at the start, they're having the affair. They make it very clear, you know, this was going on before the murder and all that jazz. And when you see them together, when Hamlet's away and they've got peace and quiet, as Gertrude says, and they're sitting there, he looks so bored, he looks so uninterested in everything she's saying. And I just thought, he's climbed his way up, and you know, it made me think, right, so he engineered the affair, he doesn't care about her at all, and he just wanted to get the influence and the power and where he was. And she's talking to him and he's just not interested. And I feel like, is it a trap within a trap? He's trapped in the corporate world. Now he's trapped in like a loveless marriage as well. And I did wonder what you thought about that, whether that was too much.
No, maybe it is part of that theme that you also detected in the Hamlet-Ophelia romance. Wanting a thing. What is the Mock Times line there?
You may find that having is not so pleasing a thing after all as wanting.
That may be the idea, right? When Ophelia realizes she can't have Hamlet, and suddenly she wants Hamlet, you know, or can't live without Hamlet. Similarly, this whole thing was part of a corporate dealing. You know, Klaus doesn't really love Gertrude. It's great because now it's a secret affair. Now that it's out in the open, meh.
Yeah, not so thrilling.
Yeah, I don't care anymore. That may be part of it, yeah.
My one note for Klaus is what happens when conscience gets outsourced.
But let's talk about Gertrude, since we're there. Her role is severely cut down. There's no speech about Ophelia's drowning. I mean, it's a one-liner, much as the rest of this play. Hamlet doesn't tell her about the murder. There isn't really that confrontation. Just tells her not to sleep with Klaus anymore. There's no context. But I did find there was, like I said, a much kinder relationship with Hamlet. She tells him about the death, which is not in the play. She tells Laertes, she tells Claudius. This is their conversation when he comes back from exile. I felt like there was much more warmth here. But certainly we can talk about her very different death, or maybe we want to keep that for later. But you go ahead. Tell me about Gertrude.
For me, Gertrude is famously, I think she's famously ambiguous within the structure of Hamlet. There's so many ways to play her. Is she naive? Is she complicit? Is she a victim? Is she pragmatic? We've got all of that. I mean, we've got, the one thing you can always point to is the sort of moral scandal of her very quick remarriage. What was that? Was she always secretly with her husband's brother, or was she just trying to protect herself as a woman in a man's world kind of a thing? You know, and she triggers Hamlet's sort of disgust with her sexuality, with her weakness, with her perceived corruption. We never get her inner voice. She's like a silence that absorbs projection. Whereas in this, if we look at it as like a sexual betrayal of the boss, it's like a corporate realignment. You know, she's clearly trying to survive within a patriarchy, stabilizing the business. There's no romantic tragedy in this version, I found. It's more like institutional logic. Gertrude is no longer the lustful mother of Hamlet's nightmare. She's the most lustful character in this, but then so's Klaus. But they're the only ones we see, other than Horatio, sharing any kind of passion for each other. But she's a woman in a system where you have to be attached to the dominant person for security. She's a governance decision. She's not sexually anxious. So she's completely complicit in this. But this film doesn't need Gertrude to be evil. She just adapts. She's almost chameleonic in that respect because she survives by becoming part of the machine. And because she's a woman in this, she can't be like a direct part of the machine because we see no women in any positions of authority in this. So I think we can quite easily realise there's a huge patriarchal force at work here. So in this, she survives by becoming part of the machine by attaching herself to the most powerful man. And she can't marry her son. The film's not that cynical. So she has to marry the next person. And it makes me think, you know, she doesn't fall from grace in this. She's an operator in a world without grace. But I did wonder, what do you think Hamlet's dad must have been like? Because Hamlet's dad was in charge. So what must he have been like as a corporate leader for her to take part in all of this?
Like, there's an original, you know, a young story between them. That's something I don't think I've ever seen. Like an entire story based on young Hamlet Sr. You sometimes see it in a prologue. I think the silent version had these elements. You know, in the play, it's mostly that Hamlet Sr. is an absent husband. He's out at wars all the time and so on. So probably in this case, like, he marries this woman who is, maybe she was herself a gold digger type character or was seeking security, or these intertwined families, which are as true in the corporate elite as they might be in royalty, as in the play. And then he's entirely focused on the business, and she is left rudderless, loveless. And that's why she goes to Claudius. And this is, in the film, this is how it's painted. She tells Hamlet, it was a cold relationship. I have needs. And Claudius, Klaus, fulfilled those needs. That's a fine take, given the absence of Hamlet Sr. Normally at wars, here, in his office, working, doesn't care about his relationship. Apparently doesn't care about his kid, because there's no love lost there. You know, when we see the ghost, they're really just exchanging barbs. They hate each other. And indeed, Hamlet killed him. The ghost doesn't seem to know. I mean, we cut away. There's no like, here's what you're going to do. And we cut away. So we're not even given the ghost's speech. Does the ghost know that Hamlet did it? I don't know. At the end, we have a sort of Return of the Jedi moment, because when Gertrude dies, she becomes a second ghost, reunited with the cold husband. Her cold first husband. So that's not a great fate for her. But
no, because that didn't seem like, I mean, you said Return of the Jedi, but I saw that and thought, they're not at peace. Because Hamlet doesn't see the two ghosts, interestingly. He only sees the one ghost at the start. He never sees the two of them together. And I'm wondering, is this a rare moment where there is some sentiment? Or is it just that she's such a corporate parasite that Gertrude, the moment she's dead, she attaches herself to the ghost of her husband because she wants protection even in the afterlife?
I think that's a good take. It can also be seen as sort of like he's in hell. The play paints it as purgatory, and then there's a ghost element to it. Similarly for her, it's like, well, to use a line from the play, you made love to this employment. You know, it's your curse is going to be to live with the husband who ignored you in the afterlife. So she is also penalized. No one loves in this movie. Not really. There seems to be some affection between certain characters, including Gertrude and Hamlet, but it's always very cold and at a remove, or it's simple lust. I mean, Horatio in this is banging the housekeeper throughout, who is a character who is not in the play, Helena, I think she's called here, and she's the reason that he's ignoring Hamlet most of the time. He's more concerned about his girlfriend and partner in crime, so...
But he does actually say that he loves her. I think he's the only person to say that in the whole play.
Like, they're the normal people, right? It's like he's a union man. They're workers. They are in subservient, you know, servile positions in the Elsinore household company. It was filmed in an abandoned hotel, similar to Hamlet 2000, what they would do, have this big hotel structure called Elsinore. Like, they're real. They're having a relationship. They don't care about what's going on except in how it affects their lives. So they represent the people.
But does that get subverted at the end, though?
Well, yes. The idea is that if there's a power vacuum, we're going to fill it. And are we then going to be corrupted by the world that we're filling? If we're talking about Horatio, let's move on to him then. Simo in this. At the end, they have this moment where they have a conversation that we already heard from Hamlet and Ophelia. They're just repeating those words. So sort of like taking their roles. And then we can imagine that in this corrupt world, in this, and then we cut to, you know, the wood chippers in the credits. Now they're a part of that grind. Now they're going to be chewed up and spit out by this corporate world. Nobody can escape this system.
Do they not leave the building then, though? Don't they have, like, suitcases?
Yeah. So in a way, they escape. But what are they escaping to?
Well, see, my thought was...
You know, Denmark is rotten, so it's not just Elsinore.
No, that's very true.
We also live in this world, right? I mean, I'm not a participant, but I am also living in this world of corporate power and so on. I'm just a victim of it. But if I had my chance and gained some sort of corporate power, would I then not be condemned to repeat the offenses of my predecessors? I mean, that's I think maybe that's what they're saying about Horatio and Helena. I don't know. But because they do leave, you might have some hope. I don't know that this movie is about hope.
Yeah, no. What I thought was, he poisons Hamlet, kills Hamlet after Hamlet reveals he's going to sell the company. He shoves him out of the chair, dumps him there. Again, everyone is worthless in this world. And then Simo slash Horatio sits in the chair. And the next bit we get basically is them going out with the suitcases and assuming they're going on holiday or whatever. So is this basically Horatio sees his chance, he kills Hamlet. And then instead of being a good union man, he does exactly what Hamlet was going to do. He sells everything. And then they go and leave and they follow Hamlet's sort of escape plan, you know? So even Horatio, who in the original text, he's like the possibility of purity in the original play. And in this, there is no purity. So he just navigates the corruption instead of standing above it. You know, whereas Horatio is like the witness of truth, Simo, or this Horatio, is like the logistics of survival. And he thinks, this is my chance. I kill Hamlet, but then he thinks, wait a minute, I've got access to his computer and 51% of the shares, I'll put them in my name, sell the company, and I will escape. And he betrays even the one thing that he was originally standing for, which is the union. Because remember, he says to Helena, our happiness might have to be postponed and let go of because we've both got to put the union first. And then he just gets a whiff of power and money and thinks, nah, screw it. I own the company, I sell it, we escape.
I mean, that's an interpretation that stands up. So in this entirely cynical world, there are no heroes. Well, we talked about Horatio, maybe we, in terms of importance in the play, we should have been talking about the Polonius family. I think we talked about Ophelia quite a bit, so I think we're covered there.
Yeah.
But Polonius, Laertes...
With Polonius, yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting because "to thine own self be true" becomes like corporate speak in this, or Sprecht. And his long-windedness in the play is humorous. But in this, it's corporate policy. He comes across to me like, you know, you get those terms and conditions at the end of an instruction manual that no one reads. He's like that in human form, you know? He just swaps court titles for like organizational ones. You know, he doesn't change much. He's management with a listening habit. But in this, he obviously uses technology, which we've seen in other versions. But in this, he says, I'm Hamlet's old friend, which really threw me to start with, because I thought, are they, you know, he's a little bit of Horatio in this from a certain point of view. You know, he says he played with him when he was a kid, but there's no intimacy at all. There's no warmth there. It's like, that's his access strategy. He's playing on the idea. Friendship is something he puts on his CV. You know, it's a credential.
Yeah.
He networks. He doesn't need curtains.
He's kind of like Gertrude in the sense that he'll switch allegiance.
Yeah.
For protection and power.
To the point where he trades, or he potentially trades his daughter's... Now, I don't know that Ophelia is a virgin in this, but he barters her virtue, in the larger sense, to Hamlet. You know, he makes it very clear. Don't sleep with him unless this happens. Here's some money. Buy yourself a nice dress to lead him on. He's the ultimate middleman in this. He's the middleman without any conscience. He doesn't own the kingdom, but he's in charge of, like, all the corridors of power. Like the literal corridors in this sense. And there's no affection with Ophelia particularly at all. Her chastity is like family capital, Ophelia's property. He, I think, really emphasizes the patriarchy more than anyone else in this version. It's secular rather than religious or anything like that. And he's not protecting Ophelia. He's managing her. He's such a middleman, such an admin guy, an HR guy. It's almost like he could have given Ophelia a form to say, right, here's your procedure. Sign here saying you will not have sex with Hamlet until after this contract is marriage contract is signed. You know, he administers her. I mean, he's really despicable in this. Of all the characters in this version, he's the one I had the most trouble laughing at. Because I found him the most repellent. And he's usually the one I laugh at the most.
Yeah, usually he's very comic. As for Laertes being the sort of pathetic figure in the play, not in the play, but in the, well, maybe in the play, but in the film, I think that like the one thing that I am tying it back to the play is the whole going to France thing. You know, in this, he's on the outs. Yes. He's a low ranking. He thinks he should be higher up in the company, especially since his dad is like CMO or something, you know, CFO, or I don't know what the letters mean, so I'm saying anything. So he thinks he should be higher up, but his office is in a closet, you know, stuff like that.
And, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm relaying this to, okay, well, what if we played Laertes this way in the actual play, where he's leaving for France and they're all letting him go to France, and then he's getting all this advice, and, you know, Polonius sends a spy after him, essentially like setting him up to fail and then criticize him or whatever was Polonius's plan in discovering whatever foibles, whatever shenanigans happened in France. What if all of this is happening in the play because Laertes is not the favorite son? Like in the play, you can easily see it that way. Claudius seems to favor Laertes, talks to Laertes first at the wedding rather than Hamlet, things like that. But what if, yeah, send him to France, a little bit like we're going to send Hamlet to England after the murder.
Yeah, he becomes a mirror quite well there, doesn't he? Yeah, it's true.
Like send him to the Alaska office kind of idea.
Send him to Justice League Antarctica.
Yeah, let's just send him somewhere where he won't be troubled because he's a loser, because we have to have him in the company because it's a family business and Polonius is one of those like second in command. So yeah, he has to work here, but he's terrible. I kind of like that idea that maybe that would be a little too comical for the play itself, but he's supposed to be Polonius's son and Polonius is a fool. So Laertes is a fool. I think you could play Laertes as much more pathetic in the play. That would be interesting. That's the lesson I get from this.
Yeah, I mean, I always thought of Laertes as being, like if Shakespeare asked the question, what if Hamlet wasn't an intellectual?
Yeah, that's usually how I see him, as a mirror of Hamlet, the thoughtless action man versus the thoughtful inaction man.
Yeah, he's the Hotspur.
Yeah.
He's the Tybalt, that kind of a thing. But in this world, there's an element of chivalry to him a lot of the time. And in this version, you cannot have any chivalry. I only noticed this the second time I rewatched it. If you look at his eyes, they're quite gaunt. They're very similar to Ophelia's eyes. And in the sort of final scene, now, I wonder what you thought of this. In the final scene, I thought, is he meant to be drunk or high? Because the way he moves, I know that the battle is very brief, but just the way he moved, I thought, is he drunk? Is he so pathetic that he's had to do Dutch courage to...
I mean, he's a very sweaty character.
Well, that's very
right?
True.
So, like, he just seems like he's strung out. I didn't catch any kind of, you know, like, substance abuse or anything necessarily, but just that he was, like, this character was out of control, devoured by professional jealousy.
Yeah, in this case,
yeah. And he just can't see the puppet strings. He's against his own father's plan to marry off Ophelia, and he's like, because he doesn't know anything. So I think he's supposed to be this character who is, I mean, just like in the play when he shows up at the end, he's easily wrapped into Claudius's schemes. He's easy to manipulate. Yes. Here they're like pushing that to the limit. I guess it does give us a performance that could seem drunk or high or very desperate. So I don't know what the reason is because we don't see anything of it.
No, it's another much reduced role in this.
But I don't think you're wrong to say that might be what's happening.
Because he's not a tragic Avenger in this. If you really boil it down, he's somebody else trying to climb his way up the greasy corporate pole. This is his last stab. You know, he's lost his dad, he's lost his sister. And I think this, on some level, because of the sort of the nature of this film, this is his last stab at getting somewhere in the corporate world. Like, if I kill Hamlet, They have to promote me. Klaus will kind of owe me one.
Mm.
Because there's no romance to this. There's no romantic dignity.
Yeah, no honor to be...
his revenge.
Yeah, no.
And there's definitely no reconciliation with Hamlet as there is in the play. There's no, oh, I figured it out now, sorry, kind of a moment. Although Death by Radiohead is comfortably my favourite death in this or many, many other films. I laughed out loud and so much... at that.
Let's wait for when we talk about this scene in our next block. But yes, it's pathetic to the end. Even this death will be ridiculous and lack dignity.
And they rename him because he's not Laertes in this. They take away the sort of nobility of the name Laertes, which implies classical heroism. And he's just got a very bland name in this. He's very ordinary.
Laurie is his name. Yeah.
Laurie.
Like some of these names have been like changed to something that would sound good in Finnish. Maybe some sounds aren't part of the language that, you know, or maybe the something that sounds like Laertes or sounds like Claudius sounds like another word, which has a different connection. So they did change some of the names. Any of the other characters strike you? I think my only other note was that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are also given the role of Cornelius and Voltemand as ambassadors to Norway. Yep. Oh, well, that's an interesting way to like keep the cast down and show them that they're already servants of the king.
They get a very ignominious removal, shall we say.
Well, they get thrown off a ferry is what happens.
Not just thrown off a ferry, because I believe that knife has blood on it, does it not? Or am I think so, because they show it. But the only real note I've got from this is this. Obviously, they become, no, they're not court spies, they're corporate network agents. But even their sort of betrayal, if you like, with Hamlet, isn't even a betrayal in this. They're not enemies particularly, they're very loose friends turned into instruments. Again, they're like middle management. They're just that layer of the company, you know? The thing that struck me was, again, it's their friends, in, you know, in air quotes, but they don't question anything. They're sort of spying on Hamlet. It looks very sociable, and there's just nothing to it. The banality of them in this just makes them even more soulless. You know, in the play, they've got personality. They've got a bit of joie de vivre and all that stuff. But in this, it's just like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, we'll do the job. And there's no sort of hesitation at all. And I just thought their blandness in this made them even more haunting, and in an odd way, even more made them quite lowercase e evil.
Mm.
Because that's the baseline morality of this world.
They're messengers, and then when the job is being hitmen, it doesn't change anything for them.
Exactly. It's just, it made me think, in this version, it made me think more than any other version of Hamlet, I think, who else have they killed?
Right.
Because they just don't bat an eyelid. I think they've done this before. That's what capitalism does to them. All friendliness in this is something else wearing a mask.
Yeah, basically. Our next block is talking about certain scenes where we ask, did they nail it? So we've already talked about the ghost's appearance. It is like a spectral appearance, you know, special effect. And like I said, we're not shown the information he gives Hamlet. Just mostly insults and so on. But did you think the ghost was effective in this?
Well, the one thing that I questioned, it's the same thing I always think about with the banquet scene in Macbeth. The thing is, we've got the dad appearing and saying, oh, I think you probably, I don't like you, but you probably love me enough to get revenge. And it made me think, well, hang on what level is this working? Because that suggests to me that you get no knowledge in the afterlife. If this is the real ghost, then the ghost of his father should say, you killed me, you swine. And he should have gone to somebody else to get revenge on Hamlet. So I'm thinking, how does this ghost work? So is this film so cynical? It's saying, yeah, when you die, you're stuck as a ghost in purgatory and you don't find anything else out. You don't learn anything. You don't get any wisdom bequeathed to you. You know, you're not aware of the machinations of the universe. So we've got a ghost sending a son that's murdered him and who doesn't love him on a revenge mission to someone who didn't even do it. And I'm thinking, is this cyclical cynicism here? It just gets worse. There's no escape even in death.
Yeah.
You know? So I couldn't quite figure out.
I agree with you. There's no, if Hamlet did it, there's no reason for the ghost to visit Hamlet. The ghost should be visiting someone else to get revenge on Hamlet.
Yeah. And it's not like Hamlet's got such a conscience that he could be pricked by, you know, he's not hallucinating because he feels guilty about it, clearly.
So Korosmaki should have given us the scene where the ghost appears to Horatio and then same way, you know, cut out, but the ghost speaks to him. And so at the end, Horatio kills Hamlet. And that's the real revenge. They could have done something like that, but this was written in a rush.
Well, that's true. Or have the ghost tell Horatio Simo something. We don't know exactly what it is. And then Horatio sets Hamlet off on this revenge thing that's for a completely different reason. And he's using him because he's trying to protect the unions.
Right.
So the whole thing is ill-conceived right from the start.
That could have been a way to explain this. But as it is, you're right. I don't think the ghost has the required motivation, nor does he give Hamlet a mission that can be understood in the terms of the rest of the film. The other scene I really like to look at is the mousetrap. And we haven't talked about this here. Well, the band that plays that song, I thought that was going to be the players. You know, when he goes to the bar and listens to the band, I thought, okay, this is the part where the first player is making his speech. This is the replacement for that. Especially since it's a very misogynistic song in line with the play as written.
Very much the replacing a soliloquy, because it is really saying what Macbeth is Hamlet is feeling.
Yes. But instead, you see him pay off a guy and there's an actual play. And I think that scene, crazy. I mean, first of all, great lookalikes, especially the Klaus figure. Dramatic music. There's no dialogue. It's just like really loud, dramatic music. They're just miming that poisoning. And then this is the funny part. The spotlight goes right on Klaus, like in the audience. He gets a spotlight. Yes. And so who wouldn't walk out of a theater at that point?
Yeah. That did make me laugh. Because at the start, I thought, that's a bit on the nose, isn't it? I know the whole point is Hamlet is trying to get a reaction, you know, but everyone's reaction would be that, you know? It's kind of hilariously facile.
This Hamlet knows very well what happened. He doesn't need the mousetrap to trap the conscience of the king. He doesn't need that.
Yep.
He already knows what happened because he did it. He actually did it. He subverted their plan with his own. So he doesn't need to do any of this except to undermine throughout. What he's really doing is undermining Klaus, throwing a vote in to stop the shipyard sale, or in this case, it's like the making him look bad and making him look guilty, and or just like, you know, just poking the bear, basically. That's all he's doing. So he doesn't need the mousetrap. If we do put that scene in, which I thought was one of my favorite bits, really, it's got to have a different motivation. And so you can do these extreme things.
Well, also, he must have bribed not just the actor, but the costume department, because they were dressed exactly like the actual Gertrude and Klaus in the film.
And the lighting guy, of course.
I mean, you got to pay off the lighting guy, yeah. But they were dressed so like them. I mean, I did wonder, because it's from a distance, I actually thought, was the director being cheeky and actually having the actors who play Klaus and Gertrude be in the play, because you're never going to see them in the same shot? And I thought, has he got the same actors there? Just to really put a hat on a hat here and have Gertrude and Klaus watching literally themselves on the stage doing the thing, and then you get the spotlight.
I can confirm it. They're not. It's not the same people.
Yeah, no. I've realized the version I watched was not super high res, and they look so much like them from a distance.
The fight scene. Okay, you wanted to talk about the fight scene, the giant radio set on Laertes' head. This is all quite insane.
It's genius. I love this.
I want to track back a little bit to talk about Gertrude's death.
Oh, yeah,
she doesn't
die
in the fight. She dies before, from eating of a poison chicken, or is it a duck?
Poison chicken
leg. Could it be a duck?
Oh, well, whatever it is, it's the leg.
But if it's a duck, it fits the rubber duck element. I mean, when they put the poison in the leg and it's just like, there's like a bunch of liquid in there, it's ridiculous. It's the same idea, the poison cup that should have been drunk by Hamlet, but instead Gertrude gets it. Here it's a chicken, but it gives us a chance to have, like I said, Gertrude die earlier and there would be a reaction to it. Maybe create some sort of motivation that doesn't exist. Well, it exists in the play because it's like when she dies, Hamlet goes crazy.
Yeah, it's a moral revelation, isn't it? Yeah, it's the mother finally sees and Hamlet finally, yeah. Because she's corporate collateral, isn't she, in this? There's no sort of scandal to it. She's not redeemed by this death. You know, it doesn't purify her, you know, or anyone. There's no healing. This is what made me somewhat uncomfortable watching this film. There's no catharsis here. There's no redemption even in death. It's just disposal. And I think it must be a duck, because there was part of me that thought they're selling these rubber ducks, these plastic nothing things that are literally hollow. And she eats a real duck, something real, and dies because of it. Because there's such of an air of unreality to this. There's nothing substantive or worthwhile in this corporate world. Shakespeare kills Gertrude to expose conscience and guilt, and this director kills her to show that even if you're complicit to the power system, there's no protection because the system's built on violence. and not caring.
And in the shadow of that, we get the actual fight. Well, fight. Normally, it's, you know, an arranged fight, and it's all like honor code and
pomp and circumstance. Yeah.
Here, it's an ambush in an office. Yeah, Laertes ends up with the radio smashed on top of his head, and he's walking around with we see a radio set, but it's like as big as a television.
Yeah, it's like a jukebox almost, isn't it? It's kind of like an old Bakelite style radio somehow. Yeah.
We talked about the lack of dignity there, but the surprising thing in terms of the mechanics of the play is that Hamlet survives the ambush, only to be killed by Horatio a little later. But I think like it speaks to that hollowness that you've been mentioning here, because it's the post-revenge emptiness. If Hamlet survives, let's say the play as written, what then? Even if it's like, in this case, it's not revenge, but even if you do enact your revenge, what then? There's an emptiness to that.
Unless you say it's revenge for Gertrude, but yeah. And I suppose you could tacitly add on, it's revenge for his mother's death.
I suppose, yes. At that point, yeah.
I suppose, on a very sort of superficial level. But yeah, no, absolutely, because Shakespeare turns violence into like moral theatre at the end of Hamlet. The ending is like almost like divine justice working through this sort of catastrophe. Yes. And there's an element of farce to it, obviously, because the way Gertrude dies and everyone shouting warnings and all that stuff, you know, death becomes meaning to an extent. But this is a world without any honour, and it can't be a tragedy. So it's a farce. And I think the ultimate farce is not just smashing Laertes over the head with a radio and then for no reason turning the music up. I laughed out loud at that. That just made me laugh so much because there was no need for it. It was just like, have a bit of diegetic music farce, full circle on that. But there's no grandeur to it. It's almost like, well, we've got to finish the paperwork up. Because we didn't get the whole to be or not to be soliloquy in this, it's even more hollow because I always felt that soliloquy is right. I am scared to die because I don't know what happens next. But if I do this, I'm going to die. And that's it. And then, as he says, the rest is silence. There's no more after this. But with this, it's almost like it reminded me a bit of Roadrunner cartoons. Wile E. Coyote and all the bits where he's chasing so hard at Roadrunner, he runs off the screen, off the edge of the film into nothingness. And that was what I always felt was the cartoon representation of the end of Hamlet. He can't survive because there's nothing, beyond here lies nothing. But in this, it's so empty that he does survive it. It's an act of murder rather than honour. And he runs off the edge of the film and says, oh, what do I do now? Oh, there's no moral closure here. I'm going to scorched earth. I'm going to sell everything and disappear. Because there's nothing much to Hamlet in this version.
Yeah, but which is why I think this is where he should be deciding that. If we're saying, okay, escape is the ultimate goal, it was not the goal until this point. I think it's this emptiness that he feels, this hollow duck that he is, that makes him decide at that point, screw it, I'm going to escape, I'm going to sell everything. And that's the impetus for Horatio then murdering him. But if he still controlled the company, Horatio would have stayed at his side. And maybe if he betrays the workers, something would have happened later on. But to that point, there was no indication that Hamlet would be anything but, quote unquote, the good boss. So I think this is the moment where he changes his goal because, like you said, there's nothing. Oh, wait, I've done all this and now I own the company and all my enemies are dead. And yet, what is this quintessence of dust? You know, there's nothing here.
Yeah.
There's nothing.
Rubber ducks delight me not.
Exactly. I think that's how we should understand it. Usually I then talk about, Hamlet's soliloquies. Did they nail the soliloquies?
Yeah, there's no inner life in this version at all, is there?
Those moments are, in other films might be transliterated somehow, but language is sparingly used.
We get the cards, don't we? We get those test cards every so often that almost.
Here's what I think was the method. I think he replaced all the known soliloquies or avoided. There's no to be or not to be, like you said. But instead, he's highlighting shorter speeches that were normally like maybe part of the dialogue. The poem to Ophelia gets highlighted. What is a man is highlighted. The speech to the players is in there. And I like the takedown because it's like tells the players how to play. And they say, yeah, we're already doing that. And he goes, oh, well, fine. Then here's the money. But also like the scene in Ophelia's lap. It's like these moments are retained. So I think like for the director, these were more interesting than the long soliloquies, and he gives them more importance as a result. And I don't dislike that. I think there's a lot of great parts whenever we talk about Hamlet soliloquies. in my mind, what is a man is one of the soliloquies, but it's not, because he's talking to other people. Mm. So it's not one of the speeches, and yet it's one of the best pieces of poetry in the play. So I like how he highlighted certain parts. It's not entirely, no, I'm not going to use Shakespeare's text. Sometimes he does. So it's not like he got rid of everything, but he did get rid of the things that you thought normally people would use. I like that experiment. I like that method.
Yeah, I mean, there are parts where he, like you said, he emphasizes different parts of the play that maybe get contextually short shrift. And there's other parts where he completely inverts things. I mean, look at the very end of the film. In the play, it's like, you know, Horatio, tell my story. And in this, Horatio tears up the letter, which has got the story on it. He absolutely deletes what, you know, the play ends with remembrance and this film ends with deletion. Mm. All the stuff that's happened. And the person who benefits is Horatio, because he can tell the police the truth.
Or seems that he won't.
Either way, he's not going to get caught for what happens. We know that because we see it.
There is nihilism in the play. Well, this is the nihilism taken to the extreme, where none of it matters. You know, it's like all these plans, all these machinations. And even in the end, Hamlet trying to frame Laertes, if you could go to the play and say, you believe none of us. I think that's kind of one of the themes here. People are lying, and it's like, it doesn't even matter if they get discovered. And because in the end, everybody who's guilty gets killed. When Horatio leaves, we're on his side, but also imagine that just the same cycle will occur and he'll be dead too. This all brings us to the final appreciation, because I think starting this, you might have thought, as a Hamlet stan, I wouldn't like it when someone makes fun of it to this degree. And you'd be wrong. And, you know, I thought it was a lot of fun. It's something that I will revisit at some point as well. You know, I thought it was like a very fun version, subverting the normal play. But there are so many great adaptations of the play. Why not have a subversion? I don't have a problem with that. And obviously you liked it, but I'll give you a chance to give your own summation.
I've never laughed so much at a film presentation of Shakespeare, and also needed like a bath in liquid bleach afterwards as well. I really loved this and felt unclean afterwards. But weirdly, in a good way, whatever that means. Yeah, he turns tragedy into like a bleak corporate noir state where you've got succession and love and murder get reduced to like strategy, corporate strategy. And at the end, now this is the thing that I thought might be more of a parallel than perhaps I first suspected, but in the play you've got Norway comes in and takes over, yeah? And in this, the corporate system keeps running after everyone's destroyed. And I'm thinking, I don't think the director's doing this, but I thought, oh, is there a parallel here of like, is the bitter irony of Hamlet that Norway comes in and things do get really dark after all these people have destroyed, and the whole thing is ground down into like, oh, it wasn't actually worth it, because what's going to happen is Norway's going to take over, and we get all these hints that Norway, the Prince of Norway, is actually a really nasty guy. What I'm saying is capitalism the same as the Prince of Norway?
I think yes. I mean, if you look at the play and you play it that way, Fortinbras is an enemy to Denmark. Fortinbras is like sneaking troops onto the territory and so on. At the end, he walks in, it's like, oh, well, I guess I'm the new king. That's not good news for Denmark. So similarly here, they try to take over the Rubber Duck Empire. Probably because of all of this, the Rubber Duck Empire takes over the Woodchipper Empire. And then it just keeps going on.
Possibly Horatio is Fortinbras in this.
I think he's the agent of Fortinbras, if not Fortinbras. You know, it's like if we're making parallels, well, old Norway, right? There's separate characters. But yes, Horatio takes the role of Fortinbras. And we can imagine that whatever happens after this, because of those end credits, what happens after this is just more of the same. And we've been in this abattoir for decades now, and it's still going on, and it's still the same. And if you want to think of the royalty and the aristocratic machinations that are present in Hamlet and other plays, and say, that's like corporate society, yes, it's like organized crime, yes. You know, all of these things have the same sort of power structures and are very similar. So yes, I think that's a very good assessment, Ryan. Really, thank you so much for doing this with me today. I know we always exchange barbs about which is our favorite Shakespeare play, but it's all in good fun. Maybe you want to tell the folks what you're working on right now, if anything.
I've got my Doctor Who podcast, which I am inexorably slowly grinding to come out again. It's called Wibbly Wobbly Dicey Wicey. It's a Doctor Who role-playing game. well, I am now a therapist, so I'm starting my private practice on that. Probably shouldn't give out my contact details on this podcast. I don't know if that's really fits with the theme. You can also find me on the Strangers in Space podcast sporadically, where we review and talk about all manner of pop culture elements. That's where I am right now. I'm also teaching Hamlet at the moment, and of course, Macbeth and Othello.
A lot of joy in your life.
Yeah, I mean, if you want some private tuition on that, that's what I do to make my bones. So, yeah.
All right. Well, I'll let you slip back into the library. Folks, if you have thoughts on this particular episode, of course, head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com. Let us know what they are. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FWpodcasts. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll return for the next episode of Hyperion to a Satyr.